There we go. We'll call the meeting of the Ag Policy Committee to order on this wintry Wednesday morning. Have an agenda with four bills on it today, and we'll get to it. We do have enough for a quorum, so Representative Johnson moves the minutes for February 28th. I want to check them over, and all in favor signify by saying aye to approve aye. The minutes.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign, and the minutes are approved. Thank you. Representative Knobloch joins us this morning. He has the first bill on the agenda, and I will move the House File 1006. So to your bill, Representative Knobloch. Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. House File 1006 is a bill that deals with our fence law. As you probably know, Minnesota has a law that neighbors must share on an equal basis the cost of building and maintaining fences between their properties. However, believe it or not, this law does not apply in every county of the state. In the early 1990s, an individual in St. Louis County notified his neighbor that he was going into the cattle raising business and that he was putting up a fence and that they were going to be called on to then pay for half the cost of the fence. The neighbor, a certain Blandon Paper Company, was not enthused to get this notice and said, "We will see you in court." It went to court, and the district judge in St. Louis County said that this was an unconstitutional taking, that the fence law was unconstitutional, and that Blandon Paper Company should not be forced to pay for half the cost of some neighbor's fence. So what the legislature did then in the early 1990s is change the law so that it said in St. Louis County the 50% fence share does not apply, and instead the fence law is to be applied based on the portion of the fence and how much value each neighbor got out of the fence. And they still have fence viewers in St. Louis County like they do in the rest of the state that are called upon to go out and look at the fence. But there they determine, whenever it's called upon, which I understand is very rarely, they make an assessment, at least they're called upon under the law, to determine how much of the fence's benefit goes to one neighbor as opposed to the other. My bill, HF 1006, takes the law that already exists in St. Louis County and applies it to the rest of the state while making it clear that in a case like the use of cattle, as it was in St. Louis County, that one neighbor, the person raising the cattle, is getting all the benefit of the fence, and the person on the other side of the fence would thus have to pay for no cost to the fence. I have with me a constituent who is experiencing this exact problem right now. He lives in Haven Township, which is a township next to the city of St. Cloud. Haven Township, which is also where I live, has a lot of agricultural use, but also has a population of around 3,000 people. So there are a lot of people living in there, too. And my neighbor has a person who is raising cattle, and the neighbor wants him to pay for half the cost of the cattle fence. So let me introduce you to Mr. Gary Blake, who can tell you a little about his situation.
Good morning. As Jim has gave you kind of my background, I have a neighbor who wants to put a partition fence along the border between his property and mine. This border happens to be primarily a slough, and he has decided that he wants to try to raise cattle there. He has approximately 10 head of cattle. He's an absentee person. He lives in St. Paul, and he inherited this farm. And he's been he's sent me two threatening letters about paying for this fence. I have no livestock. I've never have had any livestock. We have a small farm, 105 acres. It's a little bit more than half tillable. The rest is woods and slough. That's where my family hunts and our grandkids get to run around. So I do not want to have to pay for part of this fence. Also, part of the fence law is that I would have to maintain half of this fence. My understanding is I have maps if anybody would be interested. My understanding is that half the fence is you go to the middle of the fence from your side of the property, and you take care of the right-hand side, and the other fellow takes care of his right-hand side. Unfortunately, my right-hand side is the part that's in the slough, and the fence cannot stand in the slough. I have pictures. It's underwater the majority of the year. Fence posts, if they were put in the winter, would be pushed out by the frost in the spring, and in the summer, the bottom is way too soft to support fence, and it would just fall over. So I do not want to participate. I've looked into this. I met Representative Knobloch at a town hall meeting that I went to ask my town hall about this. They had never heard of the law before. I went to the Sherburn County attorney, had an appointment there. They had never heard of the law before, and they told me it predated statehood. So I can see where maybe this law was beneficial, 150 years ago when there was no cars and everybody had horses, but it is no longer applicable. There are very few people in Sherburn County that own livestock, and I don't feel like I should have to pay for half of this fence. I equate it to I need to paint my house. And so I go to my neighbor and I say, I want to paint my house. You have to pay for half the paint and do half the labor. I see no difference between that and this partition fence that I have no use for. If there's any questions, I'd be happy to take them.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I should mention, I did meet with several representatives of some of the different agricultural groups last week, the cattlemen, NFO, Farm Bureau, and I guess I would say I think they recognize that there is an issue here. I haven't heard back from them. I was hoping and still hope that, you know, they maybe would have some other thoughts on, you know, other possibilities, and I'm open to suggestions. But to me, you know, we have the odd situation where we have a law. We have two laws for the same subject in the state, and one law affects every county except St. Louis County, and the other law affects just St. Louis County. And so, to me, I think this is actually a law that dates back to territorial days. There aren't that many of those on the books, but this one does, and I think that the time has come to modify it according to the way we've already modified it for one county.
Representative Poppy had a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and to the testifier, you're telling us that this fence already exists. Is that correct?
A portion of the
fence. Mr. Blake, go ahead.
Yeah, I'm sorry. A portion of the fence exists. I have maps I could show you. There's a portion of the fence that goes along a field, cornfield, active cornfield, and that is standing, and then it goes on through the slough. This man put this fence up about 7 years ago, didn't go through the proper channels, he just put it up. And I thought, well, if he wants to have a fence, I don't care. He asked for my permission to go across my property to maintain the fence. And I said, absolutely, you can. Well, it didn't stand. I knew it wouldn't stand. And he has been putting pressure on me, and again, I could show you with the maps if you cared to see it, to move the fence onto my high ground, wooded ground, instead of my slough property, therefore giving up a bunch of my property. And I have refused to do so. And he has used this fence law. Yeah, I have two threatening letters trying to force me to do that, and I refuse to do it, so now he's trying to get me to pay for the fence in the slough.
Follow-up, Representative?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And to Representative Knobloch, this is effective in August 1, 2017. So would that mean that your testifier, would this in fact help him or not necessarily?
Representative Knobloch.
Well, I guess that's a good question, Representative Poppy. The effective date is it would apply to fences built on or after that date. So clearly any new fence built on or after that date would apply. I guess it's my intent that, you know, old fences, you know, that exist, I guess it was my intent that people would not, I mean, my constituent wouldn't be called upon to maintain the old fence that he didn't want, but that's a question maybe I should have some sort of clarifying amendment on.
I think what you may be getting at, could there be a rush of new fencing put in before August 1st?
That's my question, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Representative Mahoney, did that answer your question?
Not quite.
Okay, go ahead, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Knobloch, you're shocked that something like this would happen up in St. Louis County? No, you can't be. You cannot be.
Well, Representative Mahoney, Mr. Chair, it is perhaps not the first special legislation for St. Louis County.
So, actually, that kind of was my question. Is this just something that applies in agricultural settings, or does this apply? I put up a number of fences in my life, and I'm wondering if I should go back to my old neighbors and see if I can get them to pay, retroactively pay half the cost of those fences.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hoyt, I think it only applies to parcels that are 20 acres and over.
Okay.
Next question. Lita. Okay. Representative Norris.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I don't have a question other than to thank Representative Knobloch. This has come up occasionally in my legislative district over time, and so I was well aware of the bill. We've never done anything about it, but to me it makes sense. It's an old law. Some of these old laws really just need to go away. It had its purpose. Now I see where it does not have a purpose anymore, so I'm glad you're bringing it forward. So.
Thank you.
Further questions, Representative Salk?
Again, along the idea of when it takes effect and how we live between now and then, I do think it would be wise to set something up because my previous life's background would tell me that people are going to dream up reasons to edge their way in relative to the maybe their perfectly peaceful understanding of their current fence, but it could cause, as you said, a flurry of fence building between now and then, and I hate that we say that out loud, which then causes the thing that we're worried about trying to not, but I don't know the best way of doing that. You're wiser and more, have a sense of the tools. But I do think that that's really going to be an issue someplace, and it'd be nice if we could be in front of it.
Well, Mr. Chair, Representative Salk, some people might dispute that wiser statement you made. I appreciate you and Representative Poppy bringing that up because I think, the effective date, I hadn't thought about that much when I got it from the reviser, but that maybe needs a little bit of clarification. I don't know, Mr. Chair, are you, in terms of this bill, is this something that you were thinking would be incorporated into a omnibus policy bill from the committee, or is it something that you were looking at just referring to the general register?
It could go to the general register. That's where it's slated to go, but it could also be included in an omnibus bill.
Okay, because I guess I certainly would be happy to have it go to the general register, and this wouldn't be a big amendment on the floor, but I could do some sort of clarifying amendment on the floor on the effective date, and I'd be happy to work on that if people are okay with that.
Oh. Representative Poppy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I do think that, yes, you probably would see, the summer is a good time to build fences, and so you might see that would be an outcome of that. I'm just wondering, too, we spend a lot of time talking about mediation in the last 24 hours, and in some ways, if you are going to build a fence and you have to talk to your neighbor about the fence, that's not a bad thing. And I just wonder, I think that going the extent of having to have them pay for it and upkeep and beyond is something else. But, I also don't want to necessarily change what has been maybe a common practice and a respectful kind of discussion between neighbors to now take that away. And, I also don't want to see fences just being put up and, sometimes there are consequences on something we do on both sides of the issue.
Well, Representative, do you see maybe a fencer neighbor mediation bill coming?
I wonder about that.
Well, Mr. Chair,
bill we heard last night.
Representative Knobloch.
Mr. Chair, if I could to that, as I thought about what to do on this, one thought I had was to just repeal the law in its entirety. But I decided, I would leave it the way it was in St. Louis County right now. Except just clarifying that when one side has no use for the fence, such as the cattle situation, that they didn't have to pay. But, The way it is in law right now, there are people called fence viewers that are often township supervisors that go out and look over the fence and, you know, verify the cost of the fence and split it 50-50. And in St. Louis County, they still have those same fence viewers, but they, at least under the law, go out, look at the fence, and apportion the cost of the benefit between neighbors. And so you still have that same law in place. People could and would still be called upon potentially in the same way. So I don't think that you're necessarily losing that.
Thank you.
Again, Representative South has a follow-up question.
Yeah, and I would encourage that may be good thinking, because we have a system or a circumstance between parties outstate, we'll call it, that currently works. There are fence viewers, they review every 7 years, it seems to have a timeliness, yet an end, and then a renewal. And so I think that the current structure actually is simple, straightforward, and probably has been working over time, and there's really oftentimes more injury if you pull it out from under them, and then they have to devise their own method and, you know, hire six attorneys and, you know, so forth and so forth. So I really think that leaving it as it is a very wise thing. I just think this business of when it's applicable is a useful thing.
Follow-up comment to that, Representative?
Mr. Chair, Representative Salkoff, thank you, and I will again, yes, be working on the effective date.
Mr. Blake, I sympathize with you. I used to have cattle and fence, and fencing through water and sloughs is not easy. And I would never expect my neighbor to maintain his half of the fence, especially if it's through water. So I sympathize with your situation. Do you raise any crops on your land?
I lease my farmland out.
Okay.
So I have a farmer that comes in and does farm it, but I personally don't.
Okay. I did talk to a couple of cattlemen back home, and they mentioned that if they needed a new fence, they just go out and put up the fence and take care of it themselves. But one did mention that, in his opinion, if the neighboring farmer, in his case, had crops growing, there was some benefit to that neighboring farmer as well. And what he said, he would ask the neighboring farmer to not plant within 6 feet of the fence, so he wouldn't have his cattle stretching through that fence and ruining the fence by pushing over those posts. Next testifier is Mr. Clavin. Go ahead, sir.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Now, for the record, Bruce Clavin, I represent the Minnesota State Cattlemen's Association, also speaking for the Farm Bureau today and the Farmers Union. They're over at the ditch mowing bill in the Senate. So I got the short straw to talk about partition fences. Roblock is right. We did meet with him last week. We thought we maybe had a little bit more time with this not going to civil and the deadline not being on Friday. So we're still trying to get something that may solve this. We know what his issue is. It's come up before. I remember Representative Nornes probably in 01, 02, I think we had your bill at that time. And it comes up every couple years, this partition fence deal. It's been mentioned here, it is old. It was a territorial law. It predates statehood, so it's been around a long time. Obviously, land use has changed since then, and we recognize that. The Blandon case that was mentioned being unconstitutional, there was a subsequent one in 2001 called the Bailey case, and that applied to elk and DNR, and it was a tall fence, and that was found to be constitutional. So there's a little bit of a split there, but I just want to mention that. In terms of the bill, one of the solutions we talked about was having maybe more of an ag focus here. Now, I don't know if that solves the gentleman's problem here because it involves cattle, but if you look on, for example, line 1.10, if we were to insert after improved and used for livestock, That is a possible outcome we could have here. And with 24-hour rules and so forth, we didn't have that ready for today. It's just something we've discussed. I got that from some notes I had back in 01 when we dealt with this, that was one of the outcomes, one of the solutions we had come up with at that time. And of course, that was years and years ago. The other thing we discussed was maybe expanding the acreage. Representative Knoblock mentioned that this is exempt for 20 acres or less. Maybe we increase that to try to get at these kinds of issues where it's maybe a hobby farm near St. Cloud or something like that. In terms of the benefits, where we see a lot of it is up probably more in the rangeland. There's the theory of keeping the cattle in, but there's also the keeping the wildlife out. We had the TB outbreak up in northwest Minnesota. A lot of that came from deer sharing feed sources. Most of the time it was the hay our guys had put up. The deer come over, they mix and eat off the same food source, drink out of the same water, and now the TB is in the cattle herd. So there is some benefit, at least more on the open range than, say, townships by urban areas where we're keeping the wildlife out. And so there is that benefit. On the crop question, if you have depredation from any animals, again, that can serve a benefit for the crop farmer by keeping the wildlife out. So if you send this to the floor, those are some of the ideas we had. Livestock use maybe won't apply here, but the acreage was the other one. And we thought we had more time with the deadline being next Friday and 24-hour rule and not going to civil. So we did meet with the author. I know he's open to working with us.
Okay. Any questions from members of Representative Salk?
Yeah, I am. I don't know if I've got a little bit of Saturday Night Live kicking in here or what in my head, but you're talking about somehow having fences that are property division fences that keep wildlife back. I there's nothing in my life experience that would tell me what that fence looks like.
Mr. Clavin.
Sure. Mr. Chairman, that could be a three-strand barbed wire. If you fence in 100, let's just say 160 acres of pasture, a quarter section, you fence that in and help keep the wildlife out. The elk herds run into that. And I think if you look at the bill, it's not in the bill, but it's in the statute. There are different kinds of fences. Some of them are as high as 8 feet, I think, for elk, to keep the wild elk out.
Yeah. But Representative Lewin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd maybe shed a little bit of light on that. In fact, on some of the elk farms, they've actually went to double fencing, and those are 10, 12 feet high with a secondary fence so that other animals can't even come close to physical contact. The other area believe it or not, besides beef cattle, we raise a lot of strawberries up in our area. And those fences are very similar to elk fences because if you get deer in your strawberry patch, you're just ruined. This fence thing covers a lot more ground than one would first think. There's specialized situations, and it's critical that you keep wildlife out of certain crops because if they've got four legs, you're in good shape. If they fly in, you're in big trouble because fences won't solve that. I appreciate the bill. It's a really important thing, what worked before we became a state obviously needs to be updated, and this is a good step forward because things have changed since before 1858, and this example of a lot of people don't realize if you do have livestock, there's a liability that goes with that if they do manage to get over on somebody else's land and cause damage. So there's a lot of competing interests. It's not in the livestock owner's best interest to have a situation where any possibility that their livestock can get out. We all carry a significant amount of liability insurance just because of that. God forbid they get on the road. I think there was a deputy just injured in up in Kinabic County yesterday or the day before. They were out looking for a lost animal, and he managed to hit it with a squad car. It was a full-grown cow, and he was not life-threatening, but he was seriously injured. So this is important, and we definitely need to figure out, get the I's dotted and the T's crossed, and I think move forward with something here that satisfies this for everybody. Thank you.
Anybody in the audience who could testify for or against the bill? If no further questions, closing comments, Representative Knobloch.
Mr. Chair, I guess what I'd say is I'm certainly very open to working with the cattlemen. If you want to move this on to the general register, I'd be happy to work with them on any other compromise so that we can get their full support as this moves forward. I do think, as Representative Lewick and others have said, things have changed a lot since territorial days. And I actually, the land I own up in Haven Township, I have one of these very tall fences on it because I rented 5 acres of my property to a guy who grew vegetables in it for a while. And he grew vegetables without the fence for a while and then found that the deer were eating all the vegetables. The deer can easily jump over a barbed wire fence, so your standard barbed wire fence that would enclose cattle isn't going to keep the deer out, but you need a good 8 to 10 foot high fence to keep the deer out of the vegetables. And that was a substantial expense. And so if someone decided they wanted to put that fence up next to your property and have you pay for half of that, you'd really be on the hook, depending on what kind of fence your neighbor decided they wanted to put up. And so I think that the law as it is has outlived its usefulness, and I'd appreciate your support in moving it forward, and would do something with the effective date and be happy to work with the agricultural interests on any other compromise we could have.
So with that, I renew my motion that House File 1006 be referred to the General Register, and as you mentioned, that you will be open to working on it. All those in favor of the motion signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. The motion passes, and the bill is on its way. Thanks, Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members.
Next bill up is House File 1032. Representative Pearson, would you like to move that bill?
Mr. Chair, I'd like to move House File 1032 be referred to the Committee on Job Growth and Energy Affordability Policy and Finance.
Thank you very much. So, to the bill, I thought we had Representative McDonald here.
Yes, sir.
Oh, okay. As he makes his way down, House File 1032 is the next bill on the agenda. Good morning, Representative.
Good morning, Chairman. Thank you for the opportunity to be in front of the Ag Committee. It has a dear place in my heart because my father was the chairman back in 1985-86 during the deep farm crises. I was a 17, 18-year-old young lad at the time and was very in tune to the issue facing the Minnesota and the hardship of this committee. So it's always a pleasure to be on the Ag Committee. It was my number third choice to be on the committee, but they put me on health care again for the seventh year in a row.
We'd like to have you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, this particular legislation is a bipartisan legislation which is intended to address a workforce issue in a very narrow segment of the agricultural industry. In recent years, many Minnesotan farmers have turned to the federal H-2A visa program and attempt to find individuals to help them grow the local fruits and vegetables that we all enjoy each and every summer. Through the program, farmers are able to secure a consistent and reliable workforce, with most farmers having greater than 90% of their employees returning each and every year. However, this program is very expensive, and a participating farmer pays the following for these workers: transportation to and from the employee's county of origin, government-inspected housing with either meals or kitchen facilities, transportation to and from the job site, and a federally established adverse wage rate, which is about $12.75 an hour for 2017. The issue that we are trying to provide some solutions and attempting to address here today is that the federal program does not require payment of overtime for these H-2A workers, as it does for other temporary visas. Because overtime is not included in the otherwise extensive list of program requirements, there was uncertainty as to whether the state's agricultural overtime after 48 hours applied to the federal H-2A program. About a year and a half ago, some Minnesota farmers raised the questions and found out that the state's overtime requirement does apply. Unfortunately, an individual worker simply cannot produce enough fresh produce in an hour to support the time and a half of the adverse wage rate, and the cost of the other transportation housing benefits as part of the program is quite expensive. Because all those are combined, here's the result. Here's what's happening. Here's what we intend to hopefully come to a solution with the bill. Many farmers had to cut off workers at 48 hours because they simply could not afford overtime. The high cost of transportation and housing, especially the construction of or procurement of new housing units, prevented farmers from bringing in greater number of workers. Without the additional hours, product was left in the field and the product was lost, and they couldn't afford to harvest them. That's a shame. Most significantly, though, of the H-2A program, the workers have lost a significant portion of their income, as a result of having their hours capped at 48 hours. For many of them, this is their only source of income. As a result, in the last year, we've seen a large number of workers elect not to return to Minnesota and instead seek employment in other states and other orchards around the states. I am here with a resident friend of mine from Wright County, Mr. Jerry Untight of Untight Farms, who could describe the issue a little bit better than I, because he is engrossed into it and in the dirt every day. Now, just a quick question before we, Mr. Chairman, you call on my testifier. Who here has had some corn at the state fair? Raise your hand. Anybody? A few of us? It's some of the best sweet corn you'll ever eat. Mahoney, you've never had this? Well, you got to get to the state fair more often.
I grow my own sweet corn.
Well, not better than my friend Jerry Untight from Wray County, who provides all the corn at the state fair. With that, Mr. Chairman, I turn it back to you to hopefully turn it back to my testifier.
Any questions, first of all, for the representative? If not, to his testifier. Go ahead, sir. Good morning.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman. My name is Jerry Untight. I live in rural Wright County, outside of the little town of Waverly, Minnesota.
Home of Skip Humphrey.
That's correct. At one time, we had a very large Democratic presence in our town. Yes, and I'm sure you all remember Mr. Humphrey, Vice President Humphrey. It was our pleasure to know him and supply a lot of sweet corn to Mr. Humphrey and Muriel's very frequent outdoor barbecues. So, as an aside, I'm a first-generation farmer. I've been farming for a little over 45 years. All of that time involved in specialty crop production. Specialty crop production, as we see it, basically involves products that are hand-harvested. We don't have the flexibility of going out and adding another 6 or 12 rows to our combine heads to produce and pick our strawberries and raspberries, because everything we do, unfortunately, or fortunately for you, is by hand, which delivers a premium product to the market and assures a source of homegrown, fresh Minnesota fresh and local product. As Representative McDonald stated, we discovered this issue about a year and a half ago as we talked to an inspector from the Department of Economic Development that said perhaps we should investigate this issue. And we were all shocked. And when I say we, it's a group of growers that work in the apple industry, the small fruit and vegetable industry, and some of the very perishable growing of transplants and flowers in small greenhouses on our farms. So we decided that we would take it upon ourselves to inform and try to change the law and seek out some type of carve-out that has been done in the past to this state overtime bill. Whether you're familiar or not, I'll enlighten you a bit that there are several carve-outs involving agriculture, a couple of them being the sugar beet industry, which is a very interesting carve-out because it wasn't brought by the sugar beet farmers. The bill was introduced by the workers themselves, who were afraid of having their hours cut back and not being able to make enough money during the season when they're working and went home, because what we do is obviously very seasonal. Another one has to do with agricultural construction, and there's many more. So we look at this carve-out as being something that'll keep us in business. Agricultural in general is not in the best shape in the United States right now, and our industry is no better. We've lost a couple of very large producers of vegetables and fruits in this last year, and we can see this moving right through our industry. So we're asking for some consideration with this bill. As you know, or may know and may not know, I'll bring you up to speed a little on H-2A. It's the Agricultural Guest Worker Visa, which is purely a federal program. It's administered by the United States Department of Labor. It also involves the State Department, who issues the visas. workers are allowed to enter this country to work under this program from approximately 85 different countries around the world. Most of these countries provide us with a willing source of workers that have experience doing the type of work that we seem to not be able to attract workers to in our country currently. The demographics have changed. When I came to the little town of Waverly 46 or 47 years ago, it was very common to have family sizes of with six or seven children, and there was a plethora of workers available for us to work on our farm and to help us, as well as teachers during the summertime and retired people. And times have changed. I think you all know that the family sizes have decreased, and it's made it very difficult for us to find workers in our area. So we've turned to this program, which we feel is a very equitable program for both the employer and the employee, the guest worker. They're treated extremely well. They're all vetted for security of our nation. They're a wonderful program as far as allowing them to make a substantial amount of revenue to support their family over a very short period of time to take back to their country where they're just not as fortunate as we are in terms of our ability to earn. I want you all to know that this group of growers that have gotten together to support this bill is a group of mostly family farms, in many cases into the second and third generation already. I think we all have that goal in mind that we'd like our children, if they so desire, to follow in our footsteps. But this is a bill that we feel is very nonpartisan. This bill has been backed and supported by the Farmers Union and the Farm Bureau. It is a very fair bill in our mind. I know there are some differences out there, and there will probably be some people that may testify about them. I want you to know that we are currently talking to everybody. This bill is not written in stone. We want to compromise. We want to do anything we can do to keep our narrow sector of farmers in business for the next generation to come. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Renteit. Any questions from members of the panel, I should say? If not, next testifier coming up. I know we have some testifiers, Mr. Ken Peterson. And thanks for the offer of being willing to work and compromise on the bill. I think we hopefully can find some common ground here.
Mr. Chair.
Representative.
Just to that, before Mr. Peterson speaks, this bill was up a couple years ago. And the some of the major concerns that we had other folks had on the bill, we've addressed. And our intent is to find a solution, not to just have this law and get this passed this year. We want to have a solution that works for everybody. Not everybody's going to be happy, but with a compromise and working hard on the bill and the language and addressing people's concerns. Henry, you're going to hear from him later, and Mr. Peterson. I hope that we can come to a solution that works for us all and really helps the program and those workers that come here to produce the work.
Thank you. Mr. Peterson, welcome. Identify yourself and proceed.
Mr. Chairman, members, my name is Ken Peterson. I'm the Commissioner of the Department of Labor and Industry, and we administer the overtime laws for the state of Minnesota. The Dayton Smith administration and our department want our state's fruit and vegetable and horticulture growers run to succeed. The people backing this bill and Representative McDonald have worked very hard. They're good people, they're good employers, they're good Minnesotans. And we also understand that those people, the H-2A employees, the people that come under the visas from other countries, they're probably making more here than they would in their own countries. There's no question. They're making more money here, even without overtime, than they would back in wherever they're from. So we understand that. Nonetheless, we believe that the approach taken of exempting one group from the state's overtime laws is probably inappropriate. And we think that in some cases the approach may mean fewer jobs for Minnesotans. And in the end, going back, the underlying policy behind overtime is that if you put in longer hours, it's going to be harder on your body. And you should be reimbursed for that. reimburse the additional cost to put it on your body. And Minnesota has, we use the federal law for overtime for 40 hours for most industries, but for agriculture, the legislature and policymakers for years have made it at 48, and that system has worked pretty well for our state overtime and for our for the ag business, I believe, that the 48 hours. So we think that we should keep the same overtime rules we have for this business, this industry, which is an important one, but it's a small one. In fact, somewhere we believe it's the closest numbers we can get is probably maybe 30 to 40 to 50 employers and up to maybe 1,000 employees that are brought in on the visa, depending on the year, depending on the length of time they're here. So that's the number of people are affected. And as long as you understand it, they get paid $12.75 an hour under the state, federal government's what they call the adverse wage. And in many states, and that, this is the problem. In many states, they don't have an ag overtime rule, and so they can run it up. They can run 60, 70 hours at $12.75 an hour. Minnesota's different. We do have the 12 cent. We have an overtime rule at 48 hours, so these growers have to pay more. We're trying to work out a solution with them. We've met with, just Monday, my Deputy Commissioner Jessica Lumen and I met with the representative group, met in their council, and have tried to work something out, and we continue to work something out, and so we'll be dealing with them over time. Same time, we encourage you to oppose the bill and not pass it out. Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Peterson, thank you. Questions from members? Representative McDonald.
Why don't you let Representative Mahoney go first?
Oh, I didn't see it.
Representative Mahoney. Raise your hands simultaneously.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner Peterson, who enforces this particular law in this particular incident?
Mr. Chairman, members.
Mr. Peterson.
Our department. Department of Labor Industry does.
And Mr. Chair.
Representative Mahoney.
And how many full-time employees, how many employees do you have enforcing this law, or is it just one more thing on their plate that they do on top of everything else?
Mr. Chairman, one more thing on their plate. Is we have told about, I think, five or six people that work on all these issues, of all labor standard issues.
Representative?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So how often do your employees, your inspectors, get to these farms to check on the conditions? Do you have any idea? Or could you get back to us?
Yes, I get that. I don't have any idea. I can get back to you, though, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Chair, I want to let Mr. Peterson know that I respect and recognize his understanding of the situation. And certainly have been grateful that you're working with us and does want to find a solution. But I think it should be noted that, as my opening testimony, 90% of the workers have come back year after year, and they establish a great relationship with the employers, a friendship, a kinship, a familyship. But because of the this program and the cost of it and the overtime, it is prohibiting for those folks that are really, we're changing their lives and their countries. But because of this problem, they're not coming here. They're going somewhere else, or they're staying back in their home. And then the farmers themselves not only are losing great perishable items and produce, they can't simply afford it. But it should be noted that by the time you add in housing, transportation, meals, and or kitchenettes, it's around $17 to $19 per hour. So then add that on top of the time and a half for the overtime. You simply, if you're a businessman or woman, you simply know that you can't afford it. So just to make note of that. And then the commissioner is a great man, and I appreciated his comments that the author is really a good guy and means well.
I didn't say the author.
I didn't hear that either.
But he is right. We want to find a solution. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Questions again, Representative Mariani.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and good to see you, Commissioner. I have met with Mr. Nutide and others on this. I think we've met a couple of times the last couple of years.
Could you speak into the mic?
I'm sorry, you're not picking me up here. I've met with Mr. Nutide and others over the last couple of years, and I have no doubt that one, they're working awfully hard to try to find a solution to their economic issue here, particularly as, you know, they're facing, quite frankly, unfair, you know, advantages that other states do. And so in some respects, we're attempting to fix something that is not a Minnesota problem. It's really a problem of other states' unfair labor practices, which puts Mr. Undertide in an economically disadvantageous position relative to the markets. I also have no doubt that he runs a good operation, you know, good people. He's invited me to come out. I'll take you up on that. However, you know, I think it's important to note that not everyone is Mr. Undertide out there. And I think that the question that Representative Mahoney put on the table really has to do with assurances that we have as legislators about what is the behavior out in the broader field. And part of that is to make sure that we're not creating advantages for folks who are not Mr. Undertide, but who in fact are engaged in activities that we don't find acceptable. My understanding, Commissioner, is that there was a case that you, that your department came across within the last year or two, maybe longer, because I think it was kind of settled over time, that in fact found some grievances, and then there was some kind of a settlement relative to these employees. If you don't have that information now, I think it's important for us to have that. And again, Mr. Chair, this is not at all any attempt on my part to disparage, you know, good producers like Mr. Undertide, but it's important for us to be fully aware of practices throughout the state, even if it's a small number of folks, and for us to be properly equipped. I mean, 5 or 6 people in the entire department dealing with all these issues, you know, there's 5 million plus people in this state. And so that's a lot of room, I would submit, for some bad characters to get away with some bad behaviors. And we're talking about people's lives and livelihoods here. And we're also talking about the possibility that good folks like Mr. Undertide wind up getting mischaracterized as a result of the bad behavior of a few folks out there. So all this, I think, has to be in the mix, Mr. Chair, as we consider these kind of really major steps relative to Minnesota's values and philosophies and our relationship with the laws and our laborers. So if the commissioner has any information on that, I welcome it at this time. If not, I would welcome it in the near future.
Commissioner.
Mr. Chairman, President Mariani, we'll get information to you. We've had issues with ag employers, not that I recall with employers of this using HOA, but I'll find out. We'll make sure.
Question from Representative Nornes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess I wanted to voice my support for this legislation. I think a year ago or so, we had an employer from my district, Bluebird Gardens, came and made a presentation to us. He's a very successful business. He's a retired teacher, by the way, but he does this now. Hires a lot of folks through this program. And you talk about sweet corn. There's a contest there, and I think it'd be a close call who has the best sweet corn. But what he told me last fall, and he has struggled because he's, you know, between weather and all the rest, the other thing is selling the product. And that's what he probably struggles with all the time. So it's not a matter of, and you can raise, I mean, so he's caught. If you're going to raise his overhead and he can't sell any more corn, I mean, that's pretty soon you're out of business. And that's what he said. His biggest struggle right now is being able to sell his product, to market it. It's just that marketing is a huge, huge undertaking when you're successful. And it's the last most important piece. And so I favor this only because it takes a little pressure off of his operation so he can be successful. Otherwise, he will not. So.
Comment, Representative?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, Representative Nornes. What's really unfortunate is the fact that we don't have enough folks in Minnesota that will do this kind of work. I think it's a wonderful program that we're able to lift the lives up of those folks from other nations, 85 other nations, improve the quality of life, their fathers, husbands, wives, children. That's wonderful. That's part of being human. That's what we must do to lift up our brothers and sisters all over the world. But it's unfortunate that here in Minnesota we can't find the workers to do that. When I was a boy, I think it may have even been Mr. Untight's farm because it was out in Gray County, I was barely even tall enough to tassel the corn, but one summer...
Are you yet?
My dad signed up. What?
You shouldn't talk.
My dad signed up. Four of us boys to detassel corn. Yeah, rule him out of order, Mr. Chairman. Who was that? Representative Pearson. And detassel corn, and I think we made about $2 an hour, whatever it was. They didn't even feed us. But it's just think about it. It's unfortunate we don't have the workers, the teenagers. Of course, they give most of it. They're given everything nowadays without working hard for it. No offense to teenagers, my own included. But that's the sad part about it. And then lastly, we're only asking for a carve-out like the sugar beet and the silo industry. And they're not taking advantage of their workers. You won't hear anything, or maybe, hopefully not, from Mr. Peterson, Commissioner Peterson, that the sugar beet industry, that it already does not have to abide by the overtime, or the silo industry, is taking advantage of their employees.
Representative Poppy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I think it's just a comment, but this is an issue, and I think that we have to, I appreciate that the Commissioner and Representative McDonald, that you're going to work on coming up with a solution that works. No one wants to take advantage of workers, if they're Minnesota-born or if they're coming from another country. I think that we really need to, be concerned about that. We don't want people to be taken advantage of, but we also do need to, help to find a solution that supports the farmers, the growers who are industrious people, here and are providing employment to a number of people. So I know that there's a tension on this issue, and it's one that I'm hopeful that there can be a solution to. So thank you.
I would just add, for the hourly wage, $12.75, and the benefits of housing and transportation and things like that, you mentioned up to $17 to $19 an hour. That's pretty good pay. And these folks are here by their own choice, and I think we need to work with this program too to make it work for all involved. Representative Johnson has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I believe I asked this question last year when this was up, but I'll ask it again because where I live, if you offer $17 to $19 an hour, I think people will show up. And I was wondering about efforts done in Wright County to do that. I think I asked it last day. Maybe this is a question for the commissioner and or one of the farmers. And I'm just wondering, have you tried to offer that kind of a wage locally? And if so, what's been the response? And then maybe the commissioner, is there any creative ideas you have to help this industry attract local Minnesotans to work in this industry? I understand this challenge. I recognize the challenge, but again, that's a pretty good wage. Just as an aside, that's the starting wage at the Walmart distribution facility in Mankato, and that's a similarly challenging work. You're working in very cold either refrigeration or freezing conditions year round, and so it's a similar, maybe a similar challenge, but if I'd like to learn that, if possible.
Commissioner,
I'll answer the second part of your question. That we're trying to work a little bit with the Council on Latino Affairs to see if there are, and others, to see if there are people that will be willing to do this. Part of the real problem is it's seasonal employment, unlike the Walmart store you have. It is seasonal employment, and so people will legitimately ask, what happens to me after October, November? I think that's one of their responses they would have.
Okay. We have more testifiers. Mr. Untight, would you care to comment on the ability to attract local workers?
As he comes down, Mr. Chair?
Yeah.
Thank you, Representative, for that question. I've spoken to Mr. Untight about that as well, and he'll give a better answer on that. Just to note also that currently they don't pay taxes. Those workers don't have to pay taxes on their earnings while they're here. So just keep note of that, whereas Minnesotans would as well, creating more revenue for the state in that capacity if that was brought up forward.
So a quick answer, Mr. Untight.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. A very quick answer. Our problem, number one problem, as Commissioner Peterson alluded to, these are very seasonal jobs. And there are some regulations about these people don't even work long enough in many cases to receive unemployment after the job, so it's a disincentive. Another reason is we post constantly, that's in our contract, looking for people. We have a problem with the Department of Labor on the federal level that when we pay somebody the wage that we do, even if they're a local person, we have to offer housing and everything with this job. So it becomes very, very expensive, and we're kind of caught between the devil and the deep blue sea on this one. But we have reached out constantly looking for more. And I want to add that I was really excited 2 weeks ago. I had my first applicant in 3 years for this program. And when I asked him if he could come and visit, he said, I don't have a car. I live in Minneapolis. So I took it upon myself. I drove to Minneapolis and interviewed him because we like to hire local people. We really do like to hire local people. And we do have a sizable amount of local workers working with us. And I hate to say this, but we'll hire you for this business if you can walk and breathe. I mean, that's how short of help we are.
We have other testifiers, a follow-up, Representative Johnson.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a quick question. When you advertise locally, what wage are you advertising at?
We're obligated under federal rules to advertise at $12.75.
Representative Poston.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Sir, I have a couple of questions for you. You've talked about housing and transportation and food. Could you kind of explain what you do offer? And also, how many hours a week does a worker typically work? Mr. Untek?
Representative, when we talk transportation, we are obligated to pay the transportation from their home. Be it in, we have workers from Eastern Europe or workers from Mexico, and we pay from that country to our farm. We pick them up at the airport and a per diem while they're expenses, so they can eat while they're traveling. And when their contract is completed, we also pay the same to get them back home to their home place. As far as hours worked, normally our workers want to work many, many hours, but we're in the mode right now because we can't afford, we're cutting everybody back to this 48-hour number, which is costing us our workers. They can go to 48 other states in the United States and get all the overtime they want, and that puts us in a very difficult position.
Follow-up, Representative?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. How do you explain the housing and the food part just a little bit also, please?
Certainly. And you're all invited to come see it, by the way. I've extended this. But we have government-inspected housing that I will proudly say is as nice as the house that I live in. And I'm not speaking just for the Untied operation. I'm talking about Pine Tree Orchard, or I'm talking about Featherstone Organic Farms down near Rushford, Minnesota, all of us. And this is inspected by the Minnesota Department of Economic Development under contract with the United States Department of Labor. We have an inspection annually, at least once a year, for them to come in, check the site, and check all these sites as far as the benefits that and the conditions that these people live within. As far as the food situation, we're obligated to either provide, I got to get this right here, to provide a kitchen, an inspected kitchen for them to do their cooking in and prepare their own meals, or we can provide a meal and charge them for it. We have excellent cooking facilities on each of our housing units. Again, they're inspected by the by our Department of Economic Development inspector. There are several stoves and refrigerators table space, and many of them have ceramic walls and stainless steel countertops. It is, I would like to say, it's top of the line.
We have two more testifiers, and we'd like to get this bill wrapped up by 11:30 if possible. We have Henry Jimenez and Michelle McKenzie, if they'd care to come down and offer their testimony. Good morning, sir. Identify yourself and proceed.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Henry Jimenez, the Executive Director of the Minnesota Council on Latino Affairs. We also support farmers and the agriculture industries. We want them to succeed. We also do believe Farmer Jerry seems like a good man, and I look forward to visiting his farm. However, the Minnesota Council on Latino Affairs opposes House File 1032. If passed, any farm worker on a farm described beginning at line 3.6, whether they are a U.S. citizen, lawful permanent resident, or H-2A worker, will no longer receive overtime pay after 48 hours work week, which we have a problem with. We understand the costs associated with the H-2A program. However, we feel the ready-made solution is right for Minnesota, and we should work harder to hire local Minnesota workers rather than using temporary visa holders. These are folks coming from other countries to come here when we have unemployment rates that are higher in greater Minnesota. We should think about addressing those. Agriculture is a major industry in the Latino community. Minnesota Latinos have the highest labor force participation rate in the state at 75%, and even greater for foreign-born Latinos at 78%. In addition, in greater Minnesota, the Latino population is young and growing. Our council looks forward to working with the legislature, farmers, and other stakeholders to find a Minnesota solution.
Thank you, sir. Any questions from members? If not, thank you. Ms. McKenzie, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm so short. Here, let's see if I can get there. Sorry, and I am here, even though I'm down below the podium. My name's Michelle Garnett McKenzie. I'm Deputy Director at the Advocates for Human Rights. And we are very grateful for this chance to just highlight a few of the issues of concern that we have. The Advocates has worked for over 30 years representing victims of persecution, torture, and human trafficking. And we've worked with this legislature successfully to really strengthen Minnesota's response to human trafficking. Last year we released a report on that issue and unfortunately found a real correlation between weakened labor conditions, labor standards and inspection, and the incidence of human trafficking. The agricultural industry is not immune to this, and in fact, workers in the agricultural industry can be really at risk. That's a national trend. We see much higher rates of worksite abuses on major farms around the country. And unfortunately, that's been true in Minnesota as well. In our research, 7 of the 17 cases of trafficking identified involved in Minnesota involved temporary farm workers. And, of course, we saw a really major criminal enterprise that had developed in Foley, Minnesota, in conjunction with an agent and an in-country Dominican Republic national, who all conspired to systematically exploit workers through the H-2A program. Those were workers on an H-2A inspected farm. And we know that the farmers, by and large, and I would say almost to without exception, follow the rules or exceed the rules and do the best to not only support their families but their workers. But that exception is someone we need to be concerned about, and eroding standards, taking away oversight, reducing the number of hours is not the way to go. We really encourage and look forward to working with all the parties to try to come up with that solution that both protects the workers and our values and make sure that farmers can make a living and get the crops picked, because we all love the apples, we all love the strawberries, and yes, indeed, we do love the sweet corn. So we know there's a solution. We don't think this is it, and we are concerned that it could undermine good steps the state has been taking to protect Minnesota workers.
Ms. McKenzie, do you see a connection in between the overtime issue and what you're talking about?
Unfortunately, Mr. Chair, we have seen that where there are overtime, lack of standards around overtime, lack of standards around or inspection around wage and hour violations and other kinds of worker safety issues that correlates with work sites that have trafficking problems. And almost without exception, if there's a trafficking case, these other violations were present. We can stop and interrupt human trafficking by having robust enforcement mechanisms on the front end that protect all of us from more garden variety. No offense, garden variety is maybe not the right term in this committee. For more common exploitation, and that will help us guard against those really bad actors that we all obviously care about keeping out of the workforce. I'm sure that the farmers don't appreciate their competitors undercutting them by being unfair to their workers. It just, you know, it hurts us all, workers and growers alike.
But I thought you also mentioned maybe a connection if they had more downtime or worked fewer hours that could lead to more issues of trouble. But it seemed like what's happening with the overtime ceiling, they are getting their hours reduced, which may, in fact, make what you're talking about worse.
Mr. Chair, I think that is a concern. We want to make sure the workers are being able to work as much as they want to and getting paid for that, but we don't want to reduce another avenue of oversight. So while we're concerned about this particular approach, we think there is the right approach that can be created.
Okay. Representative Mariani.
Mr. Chair, and I wonder if Mr. Jimenez can return to the testimony table, and may need help from counsel as well. So, Mr. Jimenez, you had indicated that you were concerned with the language on line 3.6, mm-hmm. and I was actually looking for what the qualifying, I think it's qualifying language that follows on line 3.9 and forward. I note that Code of Federal Regulations, Title 29, Section 1910.142, addresses temporary labor camps. And then there's other language here, so I'm a little less sure about what the construct means here, so that's where I may need help with counsel here. But before I do that, if you can tell me, when you express that concern, are you saying that this language would apply beyond H-2A visa workers? Is that the concern? Because I have met with the advocates, and I know that they were trying to look for a way to, you know, really focus this legislation. So this language, I think, is narrower than it was last year's, where it was super broad. But it sounds like perhaps there continues to be a concern here relative to the construct of this language.
Mr. Jimenez.
Mr. Chair, Representative Mariani, the way we interpret it is that it would impact folks who are, you know, local residents that work in that farm who take on H-2A visa holders because the rules would apply to them as well. So it would impact Minnesotans.
Yes. Representative Mariani?
Mr. Chair, I note that Ms. McKenzie is an attorney, too, and I see you nodding, and so maybe if you can add a little bit more, and perhaps our counsel might also shed some light on this question.
Ms. McKenzie.
Mr. Chair, Representative, yes, the farm itself, if a farm has H-2A workers on it, all of the workers, whether they're actual visa holders, foreign workers who've come in on the program, or they're a U.S. citizen worker who's working on that site, are subject to the same rules. So everything follows the farm, not the worker, not the visa holder. And in this case, the way that the language is written, it does say any individual employed in the production on a farm that has these standards, that is an H-2A farm, would be subject, would be exempt from the overtime rules.
Okay. Question from Representative Kunesh-Podin.
Thank you. That was very similar to my question. I was just trying to get some clarification that this only applies to the H-2A employees, but that's not the case. So if let's say, Representative Anderson's children got together a group of their pals and said, let's go out in the fields and help in the fields, this would also apply to them. They would not receive overtime after the 48th hour.
Yeah. Mr. Jimenez, Mr. Chair, Representative, to give you another example, let's say college students go back to Greater Minnesota where they live and they want to work on a farm that just happens to also have H-2A workers, then those rules would apply to that college student who's returning home to work at the farms.
Representative McDonald.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just to clarify that, this would not qualify for a worker who's not from another country unless they are subject to all the other requirements according to federal law. Unless the farmer is housing them, transporting them, feeding them, it would not apply, and overtime would apply then. So that should be noted and clarified.
Representative Poston?
Thank you, Mr.
Again, we have time deadline we're running up against. With these workers being held to 48 hours, do any of these workers have other jobs? Or are they able to have other jobs, and do they?
Who wants to tackle that one?
Well, can I say that I look forward to meeting these workers in the near future when I go to visit Jerry's farm, but I think he would probably be the best to answer this question.
Mr. Montai.
Representative, we are not allowed to allow them to work any other place by federal statute. They're totally committed to working under the contract they've signed with us as an employer.
Anybody else in the audience who could testify either for or against the bill? If not, any close? Oh, Representative Poppy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just another question. The workers be select? Can the employers be selective on which workers work beyond 48 hours? Can you determine? So, if you have H-2A people and people from Minneapolis that are working, would you be able to say these five people are the only ones out of my 15 that I'm going to allow doing over? I mean, can you reduce your costs? Just trying to figure out if you can reduce your costs and be a little maybe almost discriminatory, but in that.
Mr. Untight.
Mr. Chairman and representatives, I guess I've never thought of it that way, Representative Poppy. They're all anxious to work many, many more hours than that. I think it's common procedure that these people are divided into crews with specialties usually. So when one worker goes, they all go. It isn't a one that I like you better than I like him. It's we need the bodies to get out there, and I think you're familiar enough with the industry that we're in that oftentimes we all have to go, and that includes I pick strawberries too. When the weather's inclement and we've had a bad day or something we couldn't pick yesterday, everybody goes. It's if that answers your question.
Again, anybody in the audience would care to testify on the bill? If not, any final closing comments, Representative McDonald?
Yeah, just quickly, I know it's we've got 30 seconds left. Just to clarify something that Ms. McKenzie said, the bill has nothing to do with reducing oversight whatsoever. So no oversight would be reduced whatsoever. Still, the Department of Labor indeed would be in charge of that or be able to inspect. And then, again, we're just trying to be in compliance with the federal law. States has shown a history of carving out for a very narrow niche for this particular grower, such as the sugar beet and the silo. So we've had a history already doing this. It's been done successfully. I encourage you to support it. It's good for our Minnesota farmers, and it's good for the workers who come in here from all over our country. Again, we improve the quality of their life. Just think if this program can't be successful and the farmers simply can't afford it, then it's not good for the worker coming here or for the farmers that are growing it. And lastly, Mr. Untight from Raven also not only grows things that you can consume, his flowers are absolutely gorgeous, the bouquet of flowers. So if you get out, see one of his stands out in Wright County or even Hennepin County, don't you? Yeah, they're all over, beautiful flowers. and vegetables. So with that, Mr. Chairman, thank you for the hearing, and I appreciate the consideration and time of the members.
One last comment by Representative Mahoney.
Mr. Chair, this bill is going where?
It's going to the Job Growth and our committee, Job Growth and Energy Committee.
Because I have a few things I wanted to say, but I'll save them for the next committee.
Thank you very much. Representative Pearson.
I'd like to renew my motion that House File 1032 be re-referred to the Committee on Job Growth and Energy Affordability Policy and Finance.
All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign.
No.
The motion passes and the bill is on its way. Thanks, Representative McDonald.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members.
Next bill on the agenda is House File 1257. Chair Anderson, would you like to move your bill?
Yes, I would, Mr. Chair.
I feel wow, you feel
cozy down here.
If you want, you can grow up there, Chair Anderson. Looks like Joe, yes.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to move House File 1257 and be referred to the Committee on Ag Finance.
Okay, Representative Chair Anderson moves that House File 1257 be referred to the Committee of Ag Finance. And go ahead, present your bill, Chair.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. This bill appropriates some money, quite a bit of money, $12,500,000 in fiscal year 18 from the general fund to the Department of Agriculture, the Commissioner, to help promote the storage and the use of biofuels in Minnesota. We have a law that ramps up our use of biofuels in the state. In 2015, a couple years ago, we were at 14%. In 2017, we're to be at 18%. And it ramps up by the year 2025 to 30% of our base gasoline is to be blended with ethanol in Minnesota. So what this bill does is try to encourage the build-out of infrastructure to help meet those goals that we have in statute. It's statute section 239.7911. And again, to ramp up the availability of E15 in the state, which would increase the use of ethanol in Minnesota. And I have a testifier, Mr. Chair, who would explain further what the bill does and answer questions.
Thank you, Chair Anderson. We have Mr. Tim Renicki.
Yes, Mr. Chair. Good morning, Mr. Chair, and members of the committee.
Please say your name and where you're from and share us your testimony.
My name is Tim Renicki, and I serve as the Executive Director of the Minnesota Biofuels Association. I represent biofuel producers and a renewable chemical producer in the state of Minnesota. And we're here to speak in support of House File 1257. And I'll just give you a real thumbnail sketch of the reasons for that. Representative Anderson clearly outlined some of the challenges. And the good news is it's a good challenge, and it's a challenge that we can meet. And quite simply, we have renewable ethanol being produced in the state of Minnesota, and over the years it's become an even lower carbon fuel than when the industry first began its development back in the early 2000s. We also have ethanol producers that are modernizing and expanding their operations, and at the same time we have a growing demand for renewable fuel. The good news connections are quite simply this. In 2012, the United States Environmental Protection Agency approved the use of a blend of 15% ethanol with 85% gasoline. The other piece of good news is today, virtually every vehicle on the highway, if it was built in 2001 or later, is eligible to use E15, a lower carbon renewable fuel. And the other piece of good news, when consumers have access to a renewable fuel made in Minnesota, they buy it. And the last piece of good news I'll leave with you is when consumers have access to E15, they're generally saving about 10 cents a gallon less. And We have Randall Doyle, who's the CEO of Alcorn Clean Fuel, who's currently in a major modification and modernization and an expansion of his plant. And we also have Greg Gust, who's here, who's worked closely with retailers, and they're available to answer questions you have. But before I close, I'd like to put this in final perspective for you. All of these good things are happening in Minnesota. And I believe you have a copy of a brochure that answers a lot of common questions about the industry in Minnesota. As of 2016, economic study shows that about $2 billion of GDP was created by Minnesota's ethanol industry. So these are kind of the macro issues. When we get to the more micro issues, this renewable fuel can help us reduce carbon emissions. And as I pointed out, it's usually less compared to regular, and that's a consumer savings. So what all of 1257 does is pretty simple. It provides technical support to retailers to help them determine whether or not they need to change fuel dispensers or tanks or maybe modify their hardware, and it also provides funding. And this is significant because you have the opportunity to create a bridge from clean, renewable ethanol production right here in the state of Minnesota to the consumer who can save money as they're putting the fuel in their tank. The bridge that you can help build is to allow retailers access to funding so they're able to transition to offering E15 to the consumers. So once again, the Minnesota Biofuels Association is strongly in favor of House File 1257 because we believe the evidence will show it's good for the economy, it's good for consumers, it's good for energy security, and clearly good for the environment. So we thank Representative Anderson for bringing forth 1257 and urge you to support House File 1257. And again, I renew my offer to either answer questions directly put for me or to Randall Doyle, the CEO of Alcorn Clean Fuel, or Greg Gust, who has spent several years in the field working with outreach to the 3,000 fuel retailers in the state of Minnesota. Thank you, committee and Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Representative Miller?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Rudnicki, my question is, with this money that's being put into this, there's kind of the inherent obstacle, but what are the obstacles that are keeping industry from moving forward with this minus the $12.5 million? Is it gap financing, or is it that it doesn't price out, or what's the disincentive? If it's going to bring more customers to your station, what's the disincentive to installing, or what's the disincentive to installing this equipment that the $12.5 million would incentivize?
Mr. Chair, Representative, the $12.5 million has the potential to impact positively 150 retailers based on our estimates. And in the current market situation, the reality is retailers are confronted with an industry that's more than 110 years old. And the petroleum foothold, if you will, or stronghold on the retailers is a reality. It's a matter of having resources for technical education and equipment change out to enable retailers to make the transition. So in and of itself, the reality is retailers need technical assistance. I mean, that's just a fact. And what we're dealing with is vestiges of the past. And what Minnesota has done over the years is put us on a trajectory to a more clean, renewable energy future. So I think the other issue, quite frankly, may be upfront costs. So the last thing I want to do is put a lot of details on the table given the short amount of time we have, but we're more than happy to share with you a 40-factor matrix where we've analyzed the needs you're talking about. It could be as simple as a calibration of a pump, and at the other end of the spectrum it could involve replacing tanks and dispensers. And if you think of a bell-shaped curve from our statistics classes, what we're finding is many of the retailers fall in the kind of the middle range where maybe they need a dispenser and they need technical advice or something of that sort. But this is a teaching tool, and it's our belief, based on work from the National Renewable Energy Lab, that if we get to a critical mass, Representative Anderson's bill will get us to a critical mass of retailers where there will be kind of a lead and a follow effect. But we need to get to that critical number of retail stations, and we believe this type of funding provides the technical support and the technology that will get to that level of comfort, if you will.
Okay, thank you. Representative Salk.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Could you help me out with even some base kind of, how many, we're talking about a change out of tanks, that sort of thing that can happen at the retail seller, right? In this bill, there's support for people that are bringing modernization to their system so that they can then be using or preparing for these different blends with ethanol in them, or am I missing the whole deal?
Mr. Chair, Representative, that's correct. What there's kind of a spectrum of what's needed in
right.
the field, so yep. each station is unique,
yep.
despite the understanding that they sell petroleum and renewable biofuel. Some stations need simply technical changes, electronic calibration of their dispenser.
Yep.
Others need to change their equipment because it's outdated and it's not compatible with today's modern renewable fuel. And sometimes station owners don't realize what they have is compatible. So the technical assistance and the technology go hand in hand, helping retailers learn if they can use their existing equipment and, if necessary, assist them to some degree to replace outdated and incompatible equipment.
Follow-up?
I'll try to do it as quick as I can. Can you give me some sense of the demographics of what we're talking about? Because here's my... Okay, I'll talk about... I'm guy walking, driving down the road, and I see so many new, converted, reestablished, or most of the old stations are getting scraped off, and a new location, a new station, and a new investment, which is fully planned and expected. And are we funding a little bit of that final decision to build, or are we funding the legacy legacy stations that are still remaining, which are becoming a shrinking number of units out there? I'm just sort of wondering where in the demographic are we actually talking? Because my sense is, and I, be even more probably bold and belligerent about it, Quick Trip, Holiday, places like that are just sweeping through cities and putting in these installations, they're going to account for a gigantic piece of what the market is. And then we have the remainder that is trying to stay in the market as opposed to getting swiped aside. So is this primarily to support those people that don't have this large business structure that helps them do their business?
It's to support those that currently aren't providing E10 or E15. Stations are welcome to apply for these grants. We had a similar program last year with the USDA money and the state money and private money that are built out of a number of stations, and this would kind of continue that program to increase the use of ethanol in Minnesota.
Okay. Thank you. Is there anybody in the audience that would wish to testify for or against House File 1257? Okay. Any last questions from members? Seeing none, Chair Anderson, do you have any final comments on your bill?
Just a quick final comment that we're talking about some good news in the state. There appears to be a compromise yesterday that came about in Washington. The grain markets popped up, and I wondered why. There appears to be an agreement. This is not official yet, but the Trump administration is going to grant the waiver on the reed vapor pressure to make E15 lawful to sell year-round. And because of that, the grain markets popped up. Looking at advanced or more ethanol usage, so the E15 piece is important. If we can get that ramped up and make it again in the summertime, we couldn't sell it because of the reed vapor pressure. It appears that could be being settled in Washington as we speak, Mr. Chair. And with that, I renew my motion that House File 1257 be referred to the Committee on Ag Finance.
All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All those opposed say nay. The motion prevails. The next bill on the agenda is House File 1192. Representative Johnson, would you like to move your bill?
I move that House File 1192 be re-referred to the Committee on Government Operations and Elections.
Okay, good. Go ahead and present your bill there, Mr. Johnson.
Thanks for the opportunity to hear this bill, and it really emerges out of this fine report that was created by the Department of Agriculture under the lead of the Department of Agriculture and a farm safety working group. I don't think I need to remind this committee that safety on the farm is an issue, and I think it really needs to be addressed. And this is our first attempt to implement some of the recommendations in the report. What the bill does, it would establish the Farm Safety Working Group as a long-term group, so we can take advantage of their expertise. It would hire a professor through extension at the University of Minnesota to really coordinate the efforts of farm safety in Minnesota and provide some seed money to allied organizations and youth education for farm safety grants. I have two testifiers. One is Mr. Paul Austin. The other is Mr. Mike Schmidt. So we'll start with Mr. Austin.
Yeah, Mr. Austin, state your name and where you're from, and be brief. We have about 1 minute to land this.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Paul Austin. I'm the president of the Minnesota Safety Council. We're here to support this bill and to support the effort and work and collaboration that's gone on behind this bill. Conversations of the Farm Safety Working Group under different names have been going on since January of 15. There's been conversations about farm safety forever, so this is nothing new, but this current iteration has captured some energy and has captured a long list of folks, like you can see in the bill, who are interested in collaborating, interested in focusing on farm safety. 7 people a day are hurt on farms, so farming remains an issue in the safety world. That's why we're interested in it. That's why our focus is here. I just want to say that in my world, you have to focus on 3 pieces to move a safety issue. You have to focus on engineering, you have to focus on regulation, and you have to focus on behavior. Rollover protection for tractors is a classic engineering example. Representative Anderson and Representative Clark have carried that bill before, Clark Johnson, and we're looking forward to continuing on that. Regulation, we just heard a conversation about as farmers get employees, they become regulated in a different structure. That's an example of how regulation comes to bear. This is about behavior. This is about capturing some energy of individuals across institutions who are interested in promoting farm safety, raising awareness of farm safety, starting to influence the behavior of all of us as we operate in the farm world, and institutionalizing it, making it systemic and giving it some marching orders. And I think that's a tremendous step forward. I think on the second page under subdivision 4 duties, number 3, 2.18, perhaps represents the future of farm safety. If you think about a farm, there are a number of interested parties in ensuring that that farm continues to operate no matter how dangerous it may or may not be. Farmer, number one, doesn't want to get injured. The farm family doesn't want to have injuries or trauma in that family. Insurers, lenders, all play a role in that game. So imagine this future, a farm safety working group that works over a period of time, that creates an education and outreach program that farmers can choose to participate in. Their participation leads to lower risk rates for them. Those lower risk rates are recognized by their lenders and their insurers with lower rates. That would be an ultimate endpoint. So with that thought, I would just like to say we support this effort, we support the collaboration, and we look forward to working with the author and other representatives as this goes forward.
Thank you. We'll go with the next testifier, Mr. Michael Schmidt. And brief and to the point, please.
Good morning. My name is Michael Schmidt. I'm an associate dean at the University of Minnesota in the College of Food, Agricultural, and Natural Resource Sciences, overseeing the extension programs for agriculture throughout the state of Minnesota. Mr. Chairman and the committee, I'm here today to lend strong support for Representative Johnson's farm safety bill. safety on the farm and the entire agricultural food chain is a very serious issue, and one that we think merits this bill and the support. While there are multiple options to change behavior and conditions associated with farm safety, we at the University of Minnesota obviously believe that education is a key component, you know, to be part of the solution for farm safety. Education is critical. Of course, you know, incentive programs and regulation are there as well, but education, we think, is where we can play a very significant role. Extension and CFANS supported a strong and successful farm safety program for decades at the University of Minnesota. However, untimely and unfortunate departures and departures for reasons X, Y, and Z have eroded this program in the last 10 years, and we're very optimistic and excited about restarting this particular program, both with extension specialists as well as extension educators, because we believe that the combination of having an on-campus research-based curriculum developer and scholarship-driven position, along with boots on the ground implementing programs in counties and that within our extension system, can be very productive for this entire bill. The roles of the Farm Safety Working Group, the Department of Ag, and the University of Minnesota, I think, can be very synergistic in reaching the goals of this particular bill. So we thank Representative Johnson for including the University of Minnesota in this bill, and we want to be part of this solution and believe this is a great first step. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Schmidt. Is there anyone else in the audience that would like to testify for or against House File 1192? Okay. Questions for members? Chair Anderson.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Support the bill. Farm safety is crucial, very important. And whatever we can do and whatever funding we can provide to kind of bring back the safety program at the university's extension department, I support. So it's a good bill.
Thank you, Chair Anderson. Any other comments or questions for members? Seeing none, final comments, Representative Johnson.
Yeah, thank you, and particularly thank you, Representative Anderson, for your support. You know, we can offer statistics, and the working group provided statistics about farm safety, but I've recently, in the last couple of weeks, had conversations with two people who recently lost a family member and a loved one on a farm. And so there's a human element here that's very relevant as well. So I will just then renew my motion that House File 1192 be re-referred to the Committee on Government Operations and Elections.
Thank you. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed say nay. The motion prevails. And we are adjourned. Thank you, members.